roll and throw. I bounce three around the edges, following the lines of power that Ali drops into my vision. The explosion is muted, and for a few moments, silence holds as the creatures struggle.
Polar Zone!
Is the next command from the diminutive olive-complexion spirit who hovers and plays eyes for me. I spin around the corner, raising my hand and casting the spell. The glue-cement mixture that makes up the grenades is already melting and burning in the residual heat. I let the spell loose, and the fires go out, the glue hardening again. Resistant to heat and cold or not, the Fraxen aren't used to sudden temperature changes, and their carapaces shatter, exposing yellow flesh to the cold. A mental command and the barely regenerated shield in Saber flickers to life before me. I open fire with the Inland, each shot shattering frozen flesh and scattering limbs. Bodies pile up and monsters die, but the next wave is already here, firing plasma bolts at me. I spin back around the corner as a plasma bolt burns through Saber's shield and its armor into my stomach. I groan, the fire quenched in my flesh, and I thank the vagaries of the system even as my health drops precariously. I trigger the potions, watching my health shoot up as my mana refreshes itself. Unfortunately, the instantaneous potions only work a couple of times a day, after which they lose all effectiveness. Between the initial health regeneration potion, my spell of greater regeneration, and my skill Body's Resolve, I can literally see my body stitch itself together. It's a battle of attrition now, and even with all my class skills allocated and Ali watching and calculating, all I'm doing is buying seconds.
Missiles!
Ali chants. I snap around the corner, soul shield triggered. I open up with the missiles, my last full load, and watch as they fly out, shattering bodies and splintering rock. The dungeon's walls crack and shatter, but they don't come down, and I snap back around my corner. The monsters are barely 5 feet away now. I skip back a few steps, wishing that the dungeon hadn't reinforced the structure of the walls. It'd be so easy if we could bring the walls down. 1, 2, 3 seconds as the monsters recover and race across the ground, skimming over the dead bodies of their comrades. I pull out my sword and set myself, waiting. Health about a quarter, mana nearly all gone. I have enough mana to trigger Soul Shield one last time, and then it's over. I stop looking, knowing there's no point. I can buy them a few more seconds, so that's all I can do.
Incoming!
Ali intones. I meet the first Fraxen as it skitters around the corner, its legs attempting to find purchase as it makes the turn. Time to finish this. The sunlight of the exit is the best damn thing I've felt in ages. I walk out, helmet down as I soak in the liquid happiness, Under Armour burnt to a crisp on my body. Saber is stored in my altered space, so damaged that its actuators no longer work. I look around, the Fraxen scrambling left and right as they sweep the exit and the surroundings, and I shake my head.
Let's get moving, boyo. You've only got another minute left,
Ali intones, and I grunt. Give me a break, I mutter. Then I lurch ahead, the burnt shell of my right leg barely wanting to move. It doesn't help that my balance is completely thrown off by the fact that I'm missing everything from my left arm down, the casualty of a too slow dodge. It's only some adventure-strength painkillers and a hell of a lot of willpower that keeps me on my feet as my body works to stitch me together. I pass right through the Fraxen in front of me, the counter in my left eye ticking down the time I have left on the QSM. As I told Capstan, I've got a few tricks left up my sleeve. Finding the group is easy. The rally point was the same spot we found ourselves the last time. I'm half-healed by the time I make my way to them, and as always, it's the puppies who note me first. Shadow hits me so hard, he knocks me over, and I find myself being assaulted by wet tongues. Trust me, a pony-sized puppy has a very big and wet tongue. Eventually, the huskies are pulled away, and I'm dragged to my feet by my friends, everyone looking a bit shocked. I let my eyes survey the group, assessing the damage. Again, Richard? I blink, staring at his missing foot. He nods slightly, glancing at the stump of my arm, which is slowly reforming. Amelia is seated next to him, a pale pink shroud covering her upper body as replacement skin. She seems unconcerned by the pain, drinking from a water bottle, but her slightly too large pupils tell me she's drugged out of her mind. Most of Makito's armor and clothing has been burnt off, the shreds not even covering her dignity. The normally reserved Japanese lady is so tired she doesn't even care. Rachel's missing most of her hair and dressed in civilian clothing, while Aiden... well, Aiden looks fine, actually. As bad as the humans look, the remaining Yarrick are even worse for wear. None of the Yarrick seems to have any fur left, most of it burnt to a crisp, and Nellia seems to be missing one of her horns. Aaron lies on the ground, bare-chested, as his flesh slowly knits over exposed bone, the side of his face bandaged. Capstan, on the other hand, looks to have been in the blender. There's so much blood, some of it still leaking from him, that I can't tell where the injuries start and his skin ends. That he's still standing is freaking impressive. When I raise an eyebrow at Capstan, he just shakes his head. Thousand hells. I close my eyes for a second, feeling frustration boil out of me before I push it down. Not right now. We're still too close. Later. Later I can process my feelings about losing another. On the way back, my body curled up against the puppies in the back of the truck, I take the time to review the piled-up notifications. Status screen. Name, John Lee. Class, Eritrean Honor Guard. Race, human, male. Level, 30. Titles, Monster's Bane, Redeemer of the Dead. Health, 1,420. Stamina, 1,420. Mana, 1,100. Mana regeneration, 77 per minute. Attributes. Strength, 80. Agility, 133. Constitution, 142. Perception, 45. Intelligence, 110. Willpower, 112. Charisma, 16. Luck, 25. Class skills. Mana Blade, 1. Blade Strike, 2. Thousand Steps, 1. Altered Space, 2. 2R1, 1. The Body's Resolve, 3. Greater Detection, 1. Instantaneous Inventory, 1. Soul Shield, 2. Blink Step, 2. Cleave, 1. Frenzy, 1. Combat Skills. Improved Minor Healing, 2. Greater Regeneration. Improved Mana Dart, 4. Enhanced Lightning Strike. Fireball. Polar Zone. The Body's Resolve, Level 3. Effect: increase natural health regeneration by 35%. Ongoing health status effects reduced by 33%. Honor Guard may now regenerate lost limbs. Mana regeneration reduced by 15 mana per minute permanently. Soul Shield, Level 2. Effect: creates a manipulatable shield to cover the caster's or target's body. Shield has 1,000 hit points. Cost, 250 mana. Blink Step, Level 2. Effect, instantaneous teleportation via line of sight. May include spirit's line of sight. Maximum range, 500 meters. Cost, 100 mana. I wince again at the low, low mana regeneration rates. Gods, I'm going to have to get that fixed at some point, but without increasing my passive healing, I'd be a lot deader. Thank the gods that the system has more than one way to get your body patched fully. I admit, I'm a little curious to see what mana shield is like, but I'll need to dedicate my class skill points to Thousand Blades before I have a chance to check it out. For now, though, I'm happy enough to just chill till we arrive home. We are a sad and sorry lot by the time we get back to Whitehorse. Most of us have lost our armor, and there are more than a few missing limbs in the group. As we reach the Yarrick's compound first, Capstan turns to each of us.
Tonight, we hold a memorial for Tahar. As blood companions, you are invited.
Nods and assurances of our presence are given in short order before the rest of us make our way farther into town. Amelia and Richard head directly for the shop, Makito helping them along. Aiden breaks away, begging off to his apartment, and suddenly, it's just Ali and me. I stare at the buildings, watching people walk without seeing them. We lost. Again. Even with more people, even knowing what we were walking into, we lost.
John,
Ali speaks, jerking me out of my morose brooding. Yes?
I grab the body. I want you to drop it off with Sally.
Ali sends to me, and I frown, looking at the spirit. He doesn't mean for us to...
Well, we moving or not?
I consider just walking into the shop to sell it. Going back in was insane. There are other dungeons, other places to explore. We already lost one. Why go again? But refusing to do so is a good way to get Ali to whine, and I just don't have the energy.
John?
Sally turns from the counter as I walk in, looking at me, then at Ali, sympathy etching her face.
Something I can do?
Yep, pint size.
Ali flies over and floats above the counter.
I need an autopsy.
I'm an alchemist, not a doctor. I wouldn't really know where to start.
Ali shrugs.
Yeah, I get it. And I'll buy it off the system if I need to, but there's something I need to know. Now, are we good to go or not?
I watch, bemused.
Ugh, fine. Back room, but I charge 100 credits an hour.
Sally replies and walks toward the back counter, holding up a finger.
And I'm not negotiating on that spirit.
Got it, pint size. Just get me the information I need.
I watch him float away to deposit the body. I sigh, rubbing my temples. He's right. I know it. There's something weird going on in that dungeon, and we need to know what. I know that, but I find it hard to care right this second. Chapter 16. That evening, we gather in the Yarrick's compound. A single brazier, no larger than an arm's length, dominates the square. A small fire burns in it. Strips of cloth, colored red, blue, and gray, are laid alongside brushes and chest-high tables. Yarrick moved to these tables where they write on the cloth strips before depositing them beside the brazier. As the humans gather, Nelia walks up, inclining her head to us. Amelia and Richard have regrown their limbs, and all of us washed and dressed for the ceremony.
All we ask is that you write a memory of Tahar on a cloth strip, one that has meaning for you. As blood companions, you will use the red strips. Place them in the bowl set aside for such strips. Before the burning ceremony, we will be gifting his possessions within the clan. In 2 hours, we will burn the strips to remind Tahar that he is not forgotten, though he resides in the fields of heaven. Any questions?
When she receives none, Nelia moves away. The others move ahead and pick up strips of cloth to write. Ali stays behind, floating next to me, his voice soft.
The Yarrick traditionally only use 2 colors, the blue for family and lovers, and the gray. Blood companions, those the Yarrick fought with, would open their arms, bleeding on the gray strips till they turned red.
I look at Ali, raising an eyebrow, and he shrugs.
I figured you'd be into it, boyo, being all melodramatic and all. Unless you're done brooding.
Fuck off, I answer.
Guess not,
Ali mutters as he floats away to a pile of cloth. I watch them move around for a while before I make my way over and find a red cloth. I stare at it for a time, wondering what to write, what memory to share. So much blood, death, and pain that we had faced together. Yet it's not those memories that rise up the strongest. Tahar, standing on a hillock, laughing as autumn sun pours down on him through a break in the clouds, covered in mud, hands on his hips as he enjoys the absurdity of the situation. A powerful warrior covered in mud due to a simple misstep. 3 taps with a staff is all that is needed to bring silence to the soft-speaking crowd. The humans have mostly clustered together, though Yarrick have come and spoken with us, drawing forth stories as we wait. It's not all about Tahar, of course. Conversations turn to the dungeons, to White Horse as it was, and the food that we are given. It's a wake, and there's only so much that you can say about the departed before you realize it's time to move on to different topics. Nelia is standing beside the brazier, an older, gray-haired Yerrick beside her. When we are all looking, Nelia speaks.
For Umbrook, a pair of throwing knives. May you learn to find your target.
A small Yerrick child, barely above my hip, scurries forward at his mother's urging to take the pair of throwing knives that are offered by the older woman. He touches the knives to his forehead, then scurries back, embarrassed by the attention.
For Inanuk, the glow lamps of Ascana that she so admired. May it brighten her evenings with her family,
Nelia says next with a slight gesture. The lamps appear, curving structures of crystal that glow with a pale purple and yellow light.
For Logram, the training waits. Grow strong, brother. For Oranda, the Ares bifocal pistols that she craved. Remember, seat the battery.
And on it goes. Most gifts are weapons or training equipment, all with a small personalized message. So many gifts, so many messages. I see that I'm not the only human looking surprised. The thought and effort astounds us. Ali offers little help. Capstan finds us passing looks of confusion and admiration between us.
Every item we buy, every item we earn or are given, we attach a message or note to it in the system immediately. It is a small skill, one that is purchased at the shop for every Yerrick at their third rotation. All Yerrick do so to ensure that the gift may strengthen the herd. We update the information as and when we need to, but the gifts are our legacy. Our deaths are written in the stars, but even in death, we can strengthen our herd.
Capstan's deep, grumbly voice is so soft so as not to disturb the ceremony. I see a few nods, even a few questions about what the skill is called from my friends. I say nothing, do nothing, as I watch the gifts keep coming. I see it now that it's explained. I watch children given a new gift scurry away, murmuring to themselves, watch as these children plan for their deaths, for the passing of these newly given items.
For John Lee, a stash of chocolates, for his temper and our sanity.
It's only Ollie's mental hiss that makes me move forward to grab the chocolate that Tahar always seemed to have on hand to offer me when I was grumpy or quiet. I take the product, bowing to his mother, and find myself back at my spot with no memory of the in-between. I find myself saying nothing still, a single chocolate held in hand. Capstan points at it. Eat. I look up and stare at Capstan, who nods at my hand.
Eat. Tahar would not want you angry at his wake.
I nod and find myself pulling the wrapper apart. The chocolate tastes like ash in my mouth. I eat, though, because Capstan is right. My blood sugar is low, and there is more to watch. Chapter 17. Sally came through for us. The next afternoon, she contacts me with her autopsy results, and I rush to the shop for more details. What she found out confirmed the hunch we had. The Fraxen aren't smart enough, aren't sentient enough to plan and plot a trap like that. Onlivic spores. A parasitic being, the Onlivic spores attach to lesser beings and invade their cerebral and nervous system, taking control of conscious mental impulses. Onlivic spores showcase a rare split hive mind with a main controller host and varying levels of sophistication and sentience dependent on the number of additional host bodies. Quest received. The Onlivic spores, shareable. Destroy the Onlivic spores that have infected the Fraxen in the Two-Horn Mountain Dungeon. Reward, 50,000 credits, 20,000 XP.
There's more. A lot more in the information I purchased from the shop, detailing everything from biological details to past encounters with the spores.
Thankfully, it seems that the Onlivic spores can't invade system-protected host bodies, at least not any with any decent amount of willpower and constitution. Still, I'm not going to take a chance that we're all clear, which is why perusing data at the shop is kept to a minimum. I only stop long enough to get the details on the spores and how to clear out an infection if there is one among us. I come back to Earth amid turmoil. Outside the city center building, the Yerrick stand in a group. Capstan is in front, with Nellia standing next to him, and flanking them is Aaron and another pair of Yerrik I don't know. Surprisingly, Zev is here in all its glory, maneuvering around in its own powered armor. Sally stands to the side too, arms crossed in anger. Facing the aliens is a group of humans, made up mostly of the city council and members of the Hunters and Butchering Yard. Between the group are a very worried Amelia, Veer, and two more of the guards.
"What will you do about this?"
Capstan growls, his voice so low it reverberates in my chest. His fur is standing on end, and I can almost see the anger rolling off him.
"Your accusations are unfounded and insulting," Fred says, nodding to the Butchering Yard personnel as he stands there in his pressed suit.
He seems confident, standing tall as he opposes the aliens. However, he has his arms crossed, and his grip on his upper arm is just a little too tight.
"Our men would do no such thing."
"Lie,"
Nellia intones, her voice dispassionate.
"How dare you, you cow!"
Eric snaps, his insult eliciting a series of growls from the Yerrik. I'm struck once again that when a Yerrik growls, it's significantly more intimidating than a human's. Maybe it's the way they hit lower, deeper notes, or maybe it's the fact that they tower over us mere humans. Either way, the human hunters shift the grips on their guns, which cranks up the tension further.
"Put the gun down,"
Amelia snaps when one of the hunters attempts to bring it to his shoulder. She steps in the way, putting her body in front of the barrel.
"No one is getting shot today."
Veer, on the other hand, is speaking to Capstan, his voice low.
"First fist. This is not the way to do things. We have been insulted, attacked, disrespected, and now cheated. We have died for these people. The Yerrik will not take any more of this,"
Capstan snarls, his voice reverberating.
"I demand these goblin children return the credits they have stolen."
"We have stolen nothing,"
Eric snaps.
"Truth,"
Nellia intones in that same cold, dispassionate voice.
"There, you see? Even your woman knows we speak the truth,"
snaps Fred.
"Lie,"
Nellia says.
"What?"
Eric yelps, eyes swinging between the two as something seems to cross his mind. Capstan's lips curl up, a low rumble beginning in his chest.
"Tell your woman to shut up," Fred snaps.
Capstan moves, surging forward. It is only Veer who manages to make Capstan stop, his body braced against the larger adventurer. Fred's eyes glint in triumph as he adds,
"It's all about violence with you aliens."
"Enough!"
I roar, making my presence known. Gods, I wish I had an aura or something to make my point, but maybe my reputation of being a complete psychopath will do.
"Capstan, you need to stand down."
The first fist turns to me, lips drawn as he snarls.
"I expected more from you, Redeemer. You protect these humans?
If it'll stop you from attacking, sure." I walk forward and watch as the non-human crowd parts around me. I see Sally standing there, arms crossed, and Zev watching me with its bifractal eyes, but my attention is focused on Capstan.
"You are better than this."
"They cheated us,"
Capstan rumbles, eyes flaring.
"True,"
Nellia intones.
"I heard."
I step forward, putting me in easy reach of the first fist, and I look up, meeting large brown eyes. "Tell me what is going on, and I'll see what I can do."
"True."
Before Capstan can speak, Fred injects.
"You have no authority here."
I hold up a finger for Capstan, then turn to meet Fred's eyes.
"Shut up, or else I'll rip your tongue out and make you eat it."
"False," Nellia says.
"Hey, truth shitter, we're trying to help here,"
Ollie growls while Fred smirks.
"Fine, try this. If you don't shut up, I'll gag you and sit on you. I might even fart a little,"
I snap, irritated.
"And he had beans,"
Ollie adds.
"True,"
Nellia says. Fred shuts up and I grin, absently noting more than a few humans smiling slightly. Yes, my threat was childish, but it's effective.
"John?"
"You too, Amelia. I'm not going to kill him or hurt him. Just shut him up." Her lips tighten, but I note she restrains herself from doing anything. Thank the gods she's predictable. So long as things stay verbal, she won't step in. "Now, Capstan?" I ask.
"We have learned that your humans have been shortchanging us. Your butchering yard men have been taking parts of the kills and underreporting what we have brought back. It was subtle at first, but it has grown extremely blatant.
Truth, Nellia says.
Fred and more than a few humans shoot her a glare. I can't help but flick a glance at her, then at Ali.
You got it, boyo. She's channeling a skill that lets her tell the truth of a statement, as the speaker knows it,
Ali explains. Fred, your turn, I say. I don't answer to you, Fred says. I consider my next steps quickly. I could beat the florid politician till he tells me what I want to know, but I'm trying to stop violence here. On the other hand...
Okay, it was more out of courtesy anyway. I'll just buy it at the shop.
I glance at Capstan, who inclines his head in agreement. Fred frowns, but it's Minion who speaks.
What do you mean, buy it at the shop? Everything's for sale, idiot. I've told you before. All you need to do is be willing to pay the system's price.
I answer, turning back to Minion.
This little scheme of yours? Real dumb. You might not have broken any galactic law, but you've not gotten away with it either. There's no getting away with anything in this world. It's always, always recorded.
Eric snaps his mouth shut, blinking. When Nellia says, truth, he flinches before he points at her.
How do you know she's telling the truth?
Because that's her skill, and class, too, I'm guessing. She could be lying, but the Yarrick aren't dumb. They know the system, and know what an accusation like this could mean, I say.
Minion's lips firm even further.
One thing about Eric, as annoying as he might be, he's also smart.
Truth,
Nellia says again. I shoot her a glare.
She's doing that each time we say something that isn't a question, which is actually becoming a little annoying. She must be a riot at parties when she does this.
Miranda's lips thin, her eyes hard before she jerks her head slightly.
You're saying we really cheated then?
You cannot be serious. You're not willing to believe this rubbish. What is this system? An all-seeing god? Fred says, waving. Come on. If the system knew all this, why'd it take them so long to figure out who burned down the Yarrick's buildings?
It didn't, Amelia says. We knew who it was almost immediately. Hell, even with my own skills, I figured it out within a few days. We just wanted to make sure.
Truth,
Fred sniffs.
Another damn alien lover. You all band together.
Amelia opens her mouth to speak, but is cut off by Miranda, who says,
Assuming what you say is true, what is stopping the system from lying to us?
Never been a case that's been proved, Ali pipes up. And trust me, with the way we use the system, we'd know.
Truth.
A dark worm of worry gnaws at my gut at that pronouncement, but Miranda nods slightly.
Very well. I'll go along with this. I had no hand in the cheating.
Truth.
Neither did I,
Eric spits out before anyone else can say anything.
Truth.
That's not entirely surprising after all the protests before, but somehow I'm still slightly shocked that Minion isn't part of Fred's little scheme. While I'm dealing with my prejudices, Miranda continues.
Very well. First fist, is it? Are you willing to discuss this matter in a more relaxed setting? Something a little less aggressive?
Capstan rumbles slowly, looking between Fred and Miranda and me, doubt on his face.
Veer speaks then. May I offer my services in this mediation? I believe Lord Ruxley would want this matter settled amicably.
Fred opens his mouth to say something, and I reach into my inventory, making a piece of rope appear. I hold it in front of him, and he shuts his mouth with a clack. Amelia, on the other hand, rolls her eyes, pushing my hand down.
I will take care of the mayor.
She takes hold of Fred's arm, her face professional.
We'll be in my office.
I consider objecting, then decide to let it go. Not my place. Anyway, interrogating Fred for what he knows is probably something I should leave to the professional. She might object to more violent measures, but the police have been worming confessions out of suspects for decades without resorting to thumbscrews. You know, Ali, the other thieves are going to run, I think to my friend, and I hear his mental snort.
Where to?
I consider his answer, then smile grimly. He has a point. In an apocalypse, there really isn't anywhere to run. Sally prods me in the stomach while I'm thinking, and I remember why I came out from the shop. A moment later, she has the same information I do, which has her hurrying back to her store to do a quick check. Ali?
Some of us can multitask. Already scanned and the group here is clear. Once the others are in range, I'll scan them too.
Guess that means I need to hunt down Aiden. The crowd is breaking up. Veer, Capstan, Nelia, and the counselors heading into the counselors' offices, the hunters dispersing. Zeb skitters up and over the buildings, probably back to its workshop. I sigh, rubbing my temples. At some point, we'll have to let the others know in more detail, but at least for now, we should be safe. Again. Hours later, I'm in my living room in the dark, staring at glowing system screens of the battle. Thanks to the drones and Ali, I've got multiple recordings of the entire delve. I've been watching the recordings from start to finish, again and again, analyzing each moment, each interaction, looking for something, anything that can give us an advantage. 67 Fraxans stare at me from the screen, silent and eerie as when we first encountered them. They don't move, don't twitch, and yet, staring at the recording, I can see the marks of the spore infection on all of them. Pause. The screen pauses and I reach out, swinging footage from my desperate fight with the Fraxan in the tunnels. I watch as I duck and weave, jumping and twisting between the Fraxan. I watch as I trigger blink step, flicking out of sight and reappearing in front of the horde that stream past me, plasma bolts flaring all around. Again, I watch the fight. Watch the dance of pain that I lay about me and the bolts of plasma that miss me by inches. Again, I watch as I blink. Then I see it. What my subconscious mind picked up and what has been nagging me. I raise my hands, backing both screens up to where I want them to start. Then I twitch my hands again, pulling up my mini-map. I set up a pair of maps, then I set the timelines to play at the right time. Start. It's there. Just a brief flicker of movement, so small I can barely see it, but it's there. A hesitation. A skip in the beat of attacks. When the Fraxan are told to attack, the ripple happens at the back and flows outward to the front. The passage of the command so fast it's barely noticeable, even with my enhanced attributes. At the same time, I spot a stutter in the movements on the map. It happens when I blink, when I shift positions in an instant. That stutter happens when the Fraxan are attempting to reacquire me.
Weird, Ali says, and I nod slowly.
I stare at the screens in silence. I can see it, but I'm not even sure what I'm seeing.
John!
Lana calls as she stomps down the stairs, sounding angry. I look up from the windows, wondering what I did wrong.
Lana?
Did you hear what Bill is doing?
She snaps, stalking in and throwing herself into a seat next to me.
He started a strip club, she snarls, gesturing with her hands. The old motel he took over? He turned it into a strip club, and he's selling drugs from it.
Oh. I absently pull out a chocolate bar. Before I can eat it, she snatches it out of my hands. I stare at my empty hands for a moment before pulling out another.
Oh? Is that all you can say?
Lana snaps, eyes cold in the dim light.
He's exploiting women and selling drugs to everyone who goes in. We've been trying to keep that contained, and he's just selling them.
Have you talked to him?
Of course I have. We have. He's saying he's doing nothing wrong. Since Roxley is the owner of the city, it's his laws that Bill's abiding by, and there aren't any galactic laws against it. He says he's providing gainful employment for women, and that we should be happy he's contributing.
She growls, snatching my half-eaten bar again from my hand and chewing on it.
He's such an ass. Is this nougat?
Yes.
I hate nougat.
She hands me back my mostly consumed bar and waits for me to deposit another in her outstretched hand. Well, it was mine, I point out, and she just shoots me a look that makes me smile.
It's not funny,
she snaps, though with less heat. No, but he is right. The city council, well, it really isn't a ruling body. Not in the system sense. And unless you guys are willing to physically force him to stop, there's not much you can do. She nods, arms crossed.
I know. It's just, I hate strip clubs. They're so demeaning.
And you don't mind the drugs? Lana grimaces, looking at her hands.
It's not great, but it's been getting worse anyway.
Amelia and Veer had to shut down a drug-making operation in one of the residences because they nearly blew up the block. At least Bill's is less lethal. And he keeps rooms and places for them to use. I can't stop them. This world, it's just hard.
Hard. That's one way of putting it.
She chews on her chocolate bar in silence after that. I don't break the silence, instead shooting a glance at the screens I was watching. Ali keeps silent, knowing better than to say anything.
You know, the council's reforming itself.
Oh, really? I don't even bother to hide my disinterest.
Yeah, after Fred's... the incident, well, we're thinking we'll try, we will, involve the Yerrick a little more. Maybe get them a seat or something.
Uh-huh.
You want in?
In what? I sit up staring at her.
In the council. I'm sure I could get you one,
Lana says, rubbing her nose.
God knows Jim will back me, and probably Miranda.
No. Gods, no. I'd rather listen to Ali sing La Bamba with his swings for a whole day than do that.
Oh, God, you love me. You really love me.
Ali croons, and I glare at him.
Sorry. Sorry. I know, it isn't what you want,
Lana says, slumping in the chair. She catches my glances to the side where my screens float unseen and frowns.
What are you doing?
Analyzing the Delve. I gesture her over. Come here. Look at this. She scoots over to my couch and sits next to me, leg pressed against mine. For a moment, I just enjoy the closeness before I refocus on the task at hand.
Ali Sharon Show. I should never have told you I could do this. I'm not a damn AI, you know.
Ali grumbles, but he does as I ask.
Oh, those things are disgusting,
Lana says.
Yeah.
Again, Ali?
Yes, Master.
Again.
Again.
Lana replies almost immediately after it stops this time.
Wait.
Lana falls back, staring at the ceiling, biting her lower lip. After a moment, she looks at Ali, who dutifully runs it again. When it's over, she nods firmly and looks at me.
There's a stutter, isn't there?
Yes.
Huh.
So? She tilts her head, obviously expecting me to say something brilliant. So? Yeah. A stutter. I shake my head and just talk because, well, something might come from it. The spores are a hive mind, but they've got a single controlling host. It looks like that means they can't focus on more than a few things at a time. The Fraxen, they can act autonomously, but if they get out of script, well, they need redirection. When they need to start a new program, they... I blink, looking at Lana and grin.
They're a program.
The spores can't control all of the Fraxen individually, and the Fraxen don't really have conscious thoughts anymore. So they set up programs, certain behaviors. Break out of the program, and the Fraxen need to be reset.
Lana nods, trying to see what has me so excited.
Don't you get it? It's a program. And what do you do when you want to break a program?
Pull the power cord?
Ali snorts while I continue to grin.
Introduce a virus.
It's only a couple of hours later that I find myself speaking with a thin, formerly bespectacled man. Leonard worked in the hospital's analysis department before the system came, and he gained a rather weird class called biotechnician. It's similar to Sally's alchemist class, except he specializes in the organic side of things. Like most people in the Yukon, when the system came into play, he had the choice of taking the system-generated best option or taking the hour to sort through and find something he could use. No big surprise that, like most people, he went with the option offered to him. Few people had the time, ability, or desire to sort through the millions of options available. Makito's husband and Jason were the only two that I knew of for sure, though I'm sure some of the Raven's circle probably did too. Sally was my first choice for this request, but it seems that small biological creatures are outside of her purview. Leonard was actually my third choice. My second, the shop, turned out to be rather expensive. It seems I'm not the only one who has considered biological warfare, and the system shop helpfully discourages that by pricing everything extremely high. Can you do it? I ask Leonard as he peruses the biological information I've provided him on the Fraxen.
No,
Leonard says, ignoring me and continuing to talk to Lana. He's been doing that the entire time we've been here.
I don't have the skills to kill off the spores. I don't even have the equipment to even start making something that could kill them.
I snarl, then force myself to calm down.
Shit.
The shop it would be, except, well, let's just say Saber costs less than the solution, by a few orders of magnitude.
Isn't there something we can do?
Lana smiles at Leonard, and I swear, bats her eyelashes.
Well, maybe. I could maybe give them a bit of cold,
Leonard replies, and I roll my eyes. He obviously picks it up, pointing at me.
A really bad flu. Something that would disorient, maybe even kill a few of them.
That'd be helpful,
Lana interjects, grabbing Leonard's hand and drawing his attention again. He smiles as she continues.
How long would it take?
Well, this isn't, you know, like hitting things. It's complicated. You've got to create a basic model, then make multiple versions of each and run them all through a simulator. It'd be better if I had an actual creature to experiment on.
How long, Four Eyes? Ali says.
Of course, Leonard doesn't wear glasses anymore, but I have to agree, he probably did wear them before the system.
2, maybe 3 weeks,
Leonard snaps at Ali. Lana nods, squeezing his hand again.
Thank you. I'll make sure to check in with you every few days.
She smiles at Leonard, who bobs his head excitedly. I watch Lana flirt with him a little more before we finally leave, Leonard promising to get us the first sample as soon as possible. Outside, I thank Lana, who just shakes her head.
Don't. I'm just doing what I can to make sure you and my brother come back.
I nod, and she adds,
It's not enough, you know.
I know. I exhale, staring at the setting sun. Disrupting them, making the spores less effective will help, but there were still too many damn Fraxen. We need something else. Another edge.
I know.
Chapter 18. When the snow comes to stay, it does so without warning. Overnight, the clouds dumped over 3 feet of snow on the ground. No big surprise. No one has taken the time to fix up the snowplows or the salting trucks. On the other hand, who needs snowplows when you've got muscle-bound warriors and mages? I stand outside one of our watchtowers we've set up around the house, watching as the hunter teams work together to clear the roads. Most of them are just walking around with appropriated bulldozer plows, sometimes singly, sometimes in pairs, and tossing the snow onto unused lawns. On other streets, mages work by channeling low-grade fire spells to just melt the snow off the roads, letting the water run into the sewers while they stand comfortably on dry porches. Occasionally, the lack of coordination between the two groups ends up with one group being buried in a house or a flood of lukewarm water running onto cleared streets while people are still working. A smaller group of citizens run from unoccupied residence to residence, ensuring that the water mains are turned off and water tanks emptied. I'm guessing they're being managed by the newly recreated General Council. Now both the Yerrick and Sally have seats at the table, which should help matters. They've even finally added Lana to the table, though she's a lot unhappier about Bill being included too. Either way, the new General Council finally seems to include everyone. I hear Roxley's even given it his blessing by assigning Veer to mediate issues. The more I see of Veer, the less inclined I am to believe that he's just a promising lieutenant under Roxley's service. I know firsthand how strong the First Fist is, and the fact that Veer managed to stop him was impressive. That Roxley is willing to give him free rein to chair the council is another indicator that the Trinar is more than he seems. I definitely need to keep a closer eye on the lieutenant in the future. Mayor Troublemaker Fred hasn't been seen in Whitehorse since the blowout. Amelia has no idea what happened to him, and all Veer will say is that he has been dealt with appropriately. When Richard heard that, he recommended we go look in the river. Myself? I think Roxley has better sense than to completely waste a resource. After all, I'm sure Fred could be sold for something in the shop, even if it was just cheap parts. No surprise there's some grumbling about the high-handed way Fred was dealt with, but it's been muted for the most part. Overall, while the Council hasn't fixed things between the races, at least it's a start. In the distance, clear spaces in the schools have been turned into winter playgrounds with groups of children working to make the largest snowmen. Funny thing about system-enabled children, some of them are pretty damn strong and agile. Some of those snowmen have begun to top the buildings. Those never last long, though, as children throw themselves off the roofs to knock the snowmen down amid screams of laughter and cries for more. I watch a kid, probably no older than 5, pick up a snowball twice his size and toss it at another kid. The subsequent explosion and peals of laughter aren't enough to stop a minder from running over to chasing the kid. I barely need the magnification in my helmet to see the grin on the kid's face. Overall, it's a tranquil-looking state of affairs a few weeks after we had our asses kicked so hard. Tranquil, yet I can't stop the worm of doubt in my gut. Have you ever found something you're passionate about, then realized no one else gives a shit? Yeah, that's been my life for the last week. Outside of Ali and Lana, everyone else has given up on the dungeon. When I brought up re-raiding the dungeon, Capstan said,
"There are many more dungeons to clear. Sometimes one must accept the limits of one's current level and move on. The Yerrik do not fight unwinnable battles."
I'll admit, I was almost tempted to bring Tahar up right then and there. Almost. I do have a little bit of sense of self-preservation. I was still disappointed, especially when he also added that they'd be spending a few weeks breaking in a new party member. Richard and Makito both nodded agreeably when I brought up the matter, but beyond that, neither seemed particularly interested in my explanations and theories. I'm not sure if they just figure I'll do all the planning or that, like Capstan, they've already moved on. After the latest round of agreeable but non-productive discussions, I stopped talking with them about it. Amelia has her work cut out keeping the peace, especially since Veer seems to be stuck in meetings half the time. The few times she and I have met up, she only complains about breaking in a new partner and mutters about rules of force. I've started avoiding her myself since she shoots me a dirty glare whenever she gets onto that topic. Aiden flatly told me to get out when I brought up going out again, and Rachel? Well, Rachel's not much better. She's been hanging out with Aiden more and more, teaching and training others, but has pretty much stopped going out on even simple hunting missions. Even I'm not dumb enough to push her. Losing another party member right after losing most of her group was probably not the best return to hunting. The only time we get her to come with us on our excursions is when we head into Carcross. Everyone's taken their eye off the dungeon, and I don't blame them. Not really. We tried it twice, and we got our asses kicked both times. Yet something tells me that waiting will just make it worse.
Boyo? Ali floats next to me as I finish my cup of coffee. We doing this?
Just finishing my coffee. Sometimes I hate being me. Downstairs, I hold my hand and call her forth from my altered space. I can't keep her in my inventory or she wouldn't fix herself. So for the last little while, Saber's been sitting in my altered space, except when I'm busy hunting. Omnitron 3, Class 2, Personal Assault Vehicle, Saber. Structural Integrity, 82%. System Integrity, 94%. Damn, but that last fight kicked her ass. The good news is that the adaptive armor has added a 20% resistance to plasma and high heat effects. The bad news is that it'll take at least a few more weeks, assuming she doesn't get damaged further, of course, before she's fully repaired. Thankfully, the only thing the repairs cost me this time was a whole bunch of materials, which I do have. Using elementally charged gold as a major component for replacements has added streaks of dark yellow to the armor plates. Thankfully, elementally altered gold isn't as soft as the real stuff, or else the bike would really come apart in my next fight. I stand there stroking my bike, and I know all I'm doing is procrastinating. Thinking of stupid shit because I know what I'm about to do is dumb. Everyone else has let this go. Why can't I? I exhale, shaking my head and glancing at the bike one last time. Huni Dragonfly Drone, Scouting Type 4, Modified. This Dragonfly drone comes equipped with multiple visual and audio recording options and can update 3D landscaping maps. has been modified to carry additional storage items. Operating time, 2 hours. Storage, biodispersal container.
Leonard came through with the virus. Now the question is, will this work?
There's really only one way to tell, and that way requires me to head back into the dungeon.
Let's just hope they aren't waiting for me.
Boyo,
Ali sends to me, flicking to me a video of what he's seeing. I slow down, then come to a stop, crouching behind an insufficiently large tree while I review the footage. It's a cat mutation of some form, a former house cat turned into a 6-foot creature of spikes, scales, and fangs. I nod slightly as I stare at the monster, just sitting there, watching the trail. Creepy, but not surprising. Cats are known to be ambush creatures after all. See it? Doesn't look too hard?
Not that. That.
Ali manipulates the system and the video floats higher as he does so, giving me a clearer view as he highlights the spots he sees. Right behind the head, a small yellowish-greenish bump that I'd missed. Is that? I gulp.
On living spores, yes, Ali replies. It's spreading outside the dungeon.
How?
Don't know. My guess? Either the spores were never part of the dungeon initially, or they just escaped the system's controls because we're not fully integrated yet,
Ali replies. I find myself grunting. How fast?
What am I? A silicon dumb cough? Fast. We're about 2 miles out from the dungeon, and it's got scouts watching for problems,
Ali says. I sigh. Shit. All right. Can we get a message back to the city? Package the video and send via one of the drones. We still need to get this virus into the dungeon. If I die, the city needs to know.
Do this, Ali. Do that, Ali.
Ali mutters as he focuses, sending the appropriate commands to one of our last drones.
Done.
Yeah, but it's more fun to listen to you whine. I shut up after that, focusing on skimming around the cat. Better to find a way in that doesn't attract any attention if I can. I'll be making enough noise when I do get in. 2 weeks, and other than the snow, the area around the dungeon hasn't changed a bit. Snow-covered slopes, heavily laden trees, and the occasional set of tracks from a snowshoe hare or some weirder unidentified creature is all that marks the terrain. As always, the Yukon is gorgeous and scenic, but this time around, I'm more concerned about leaving easy-to-follow tracks than how pretty everything is. Unfortunately, there's not much I can do about the fact that each of my armor-clad steps is leaving a set of tracks a blind man could follow. The only thing that can fix that is a strong wind or another big snowfall, and the clear skies and dead air tell me I'm not in luck today. It makes my path into the dungeon a circuitous and slow route, but luckily, the unlivic spores seem more interested in setting up fixed guard positions rather than roving guards. Interestingly enough, there aren't any guards at the actual dungeon entrance itself. I'm not sure if the spores are just that confident or just that dumb, but I'll take it. Not that I expect my presence to be hidden very soon. In the first chamber, I find nothing. It's rare to find monsters hanging out in the first chamber of most dungeons. At most, you get a trap. For a moment, I wonder why that is before I refocus. Right. Horde of mind-controlling Fraxen ready to burn me to pieces. Finding a place to hide is a tense, stomach-clenching affair, even if I'm not heading much farther than the first cavern. I know I can run with the QSM, but its 5-minute charge makes it a trump card I can only play with care. That means good old stealth skills are more important in everyday use, and luckily, all that time hunting solo has leveled mine up significantly. Once I'm hidden, I launch my last 2 drones. I wish I had all 3, but getting word back to the city was more important. Curled up in a small rock outcropping halfway up the cavern, I remotely guide the drones in while letting Ali watch out for potential bad guys. I keep the drones high and quiet, edging in deeper and deeper along the paths I can see. I need to hit as many of these Fraxen as I can, but there's only so far that I can guide them before the signal breaks down completely. After that, they'll have to run on their own onboard programming. That's one of the reasons the Yerrik don't use drones much. Not only do you have to have someone watching the drones consistently to get the data you need, it's often not as good as the information you could get from skills. Add the fact that if you push them too far, they have a tendency to break down or get smashed by monsters, and you can see why the Yerrik just don't see them as a good use of their money. Overall, I can see their points, but then you get a situation like this. I grin as the first drone comes across the first group of Fraxen. There's only a half dozen of them, most of them half grown, which tells me they haven't recovered completely from our last encounter. That's pretty good news. I drop a quarter of one drone's payload and keep flying, passing my last stand before the signal finally shorts out. I swear softly, hoping it's enough. Theoretically, all I need to do is ensure that the virus itself is spread around sufficiently, then it should propagate without a problem. According to Leonard, the virus is both airborne and system-borne. That is, the system helps the infection process. I'm not entirely sure what that means or why he gets grumpy when I call it a virus, but considering I never took biology and he insists on explaining everything in as many four-syllable words as he can, I'm okay with that. So long as it works, I'll even forgive him for asking Lana out. Not that I have a right to get angry that he did. It's not as if Lana and I have done anything more than, well, talk. Irrational jealousy is irrational. So long as I realize it's irrational, I can keep it in check. However, I do wonder if I should be asking her out. I grunt, shaking my head and refocus on the feeds. I need to stop thinking about this. Sitting in the middle of a dungeon, waiting for my drones to either get caught or do their job, is not the right time or place to think about dating. Anyway, I don't have much to offer the lady. I'm a suicidal, hot-tempered mess of a man. She deserves better. Thankfully, before I get even more morose and idiotic, the feed from one of my drones comes back. It's the one I sent on one of the side paths that the Fraxen used to flank us before. The moment it connects, the map updates, and I let out a low whistle. Jesus. The pathway leads down to a chamber beneath me, which seems to store a huge number of the Fraxen. They're still doing that creepy, completely still thing, not even moving when the drone dumps its cargo. I don't have time to watch further, though, because Ollie hisses at me, making my minimap bloom. Looks like the Fraxen around me are scuttling now, searching. I guess the other drone got caught. A quick command sends the drone I have in control into hiding and hibernation mode in the vague hope that I can retrieve it later, before I drop to the ground and run. Time to go. Running out of this dungeon with Ali floating beside me is beginning to get very old. A few of the infected monsters charge in, blips on my screen that flow toward me, but I ignore them. I've got too much of a head start on all but the cat I'm running toward. Really? It's stupid of the spores to charge me. The cat doesn't stand a chance as I behead it. Then again, we've established that the spores aren't that smart. Yet. Chapter 19. A bigger, better man would take this opportunity to say I told you so, passing by, I say into the stunned silence of the gathered great and powerful of Whitehorse after Ali finished his presentation. I let the silence linger for a few more moments. I told you so. John, Lana says, her tone cool. I flash her a smile, but I quiet down. Some are still pushing on their data screens, trying to make the information we presented say something, anything other than what it does. Others, having read it, turn to me or their respective leaders, waiting for an answer. No one provides one, though, because there really isn't an easy answer.
Very well, Redeemer. You were correct. I expect you have a solution.
Nellia finally breaks the silence, staring at me. I smile grimly and shake my head. No, I don't have a solution. I do have some suggestions. First, we send a team to wipe out the current scouts and guards the spores have set up. That should slow the spread a bit since it takes a critical mass of the spores to begin infection. Right, Leonard? Leonard twitches, obviously not used to being in this kind of company, before he jerkily nods. We'll still need to deal with the spores eventually, but taking out the scouts will buy us time. Second, we need an answer from the system, and we need it sooner rather than later. Are the spores part of the dungeon, or are they an invader? The first means we'll constantly be dealing with their production, constantly having to destroy them as the system recreates the spores. That means we'll need a much more permanent solution to their spread. The second, well, the second is simpler. We just kill everything that has the spore and burn it all down.
If you knew to ask that question, why didn't you get the answer?
Bill asks, hands steepled. I flash him a grin. Because the answer to that question is about 50,000 credits.